But if you ever give a comment on what this is?
Yeah.
He's right.
Okay, you couldn't say it any better kind of thing, and yet we keep... Now, how can we... the Evergreens have much optimism about the success of their agenda, right?
Oh, yes.
Is there anything that I can do to help in expanding this?
Well, live a happy life.
Well, what about the information that I'm gathering?
Well, use it how you see fit.
All right. It is true, according to the Visitors of Time and Space booklet, that extraterrestrial intelligences were affecting humanity in the past and making cultural advances.
Yes.
Now, at that time, was there any shaman channeling information that was explaining to the tribe that experienced extraterrestrial intelligence was helping explain to them what they were experiencing?
Not so much that.
So this is new, where we have you helping us interact with this extraterrestrial intelligence that's coming to us right now.
We understand it. We are not path makers for them. We are path makers for a certain consciousness. The objective of ourselves is... It is necessary for man to understand the reasons why he does what he does. The description of man, as found through his description of God, has shifted. Now, as that shift continues, where does it place man's consciousness?
I asked that question on my show the other night. I was saying, I mean, the West has the consciousness in the head. The Orientals are mystical third world cultures, like the Indians have their consciousness in their lungs and their breath and their heart. But I say the consciousness is not in the body anymore. It's there in the body. Are you yawning or you're getting ready to speak?
We're saying that each society would place consciousness where it chooses to.
Yes.
It's convenient to put consciousness between your eyes. It's convenient. But that is where self is put.
That's common to all cultures?
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, it's common to call self and consciousness by the same name. Me.
Yeah.
Which is not accurate. But it's convenient. Unfortunately, it leads in the wrong direction. But consciousness, as McLuhan so aptly saw it, and the extension of other philosophical understandings where man living in a cave was used as an example, McLuhan saw that consciousness changed through methodologies of communication. The book was considered a very powerful tool capable of destroying societies. So therefore, the book was kept in the hands of those who controlled. Now, what does a book do? To understand that is necessary to go back some several thousand years. When there is an oral tradition and there is no book, memory is greatly enhanced. However, not everyone have the ability. Memory, there were certain, as in East, as in African, the Gringoires will be able to give an entire lineage of a family. But you have to train a Gringoire. Not everybody could be trained. But nonetheless, the world existed through oral tradition, by the use of memory, by the training of memory. The book was the introduction into the system so there would not be the reliance on those who had that orbital memory.
By book, you mean before the printing press?
Oh, long before.
Yeah, writing itself.
Long before.
You mean by writing?
Yes.
Yeah.
And a method of storing it.
Yes.
Now, these were kept, these writings were kept by those who ruled. And those who did this eliminated, as much as they could, the memorizers. Those who knew held sway. The book was then realized as an explosive force. So therefore, books were limited. Its most strongest phase of this, as far as Western culture is concerned, is the Dark Ages. The book was proscribed only to those who would know how to use the information, and that group was very, very small. It still carried over into this time by the banning of books. The knowledge would harm, or so it's believed. Look at the index of prohibited books to the Catholic Church. The index of books prohibited to East Germans. The index of books prohibited in Africa. You see? Knowledge is power. I'll go back further to the printing press. But that explosion of the printing press, which had existed for thousands of years in the East, in a Western culture, where the consciousness was that which it was, it was a fuse that lit an explosion. Why did it not work in China? It did, but the beliefs were that books were but for poetry.
Rather than, what's the opposite of poetry here?
Administration,
yeah. Is Marshall McLuhan a member of the Evergreens?
No. But we can rapidly, through resonance, be in contact with that individual.
And access him.
Absolutely, yes.
Is he working on his theories about this lifetime in the 20th century and updating them from the perspective he's in the experience he's having now?
Yes.
Is he satisfied with his books and what he wrote compared to what he can see now?
No, he knew he did the best that he could.
And we're getting an update on his thinking.
Yes.
All right. I do want to go back to the... I forgot something about the mescaline and the LSD. You said to Carolyn that she had the experience of mescaline, and then, I don't know if it occurred to her, but you suggested to her that she could, if she could have it through a drug, then she could have it naturally, or could access that experience without the drug. Do you remember saying that
yes.
to her?
Yes. Oh, yes, indeed.
And you said because the substance was activated, or because the experience was activated in the body, that meant that substance that she took was in the body.
The substance is there.
Does that mean mescaline is in the body?
Now, the substance was there. It made certain alterations at the sensorium. Now those patterns are there in the sensorium. They're there. But all she'd need to do, as any mescaline user needs to do, is not take the substance anymore, but just give themselves the permission to access that which they've created within themselves. It's a creation.
Where, when you said the substance was in the body...
What we meant was that the substance, not mescaline itself, but the substance of mescaline, which is that which is learned from that mescaline, is there. Virtually as if the body is flooded with mescaline, but is not.
So it's some kind of consciousness retrieval of the experience in memory, and that's part of substance. the internal substance.
Yes.
It's like a mind-body interplay.
Yes.
Yeah. So, yeah, she was saying the other night that she can think of it and sort of feel it. It seems to me that she couldn't get it as powerful, but she could probably say she is getting it as powerfully.
No, sure. The circumstances are not exactly the same. If you would see masculine rituals, they are extremely accurate in trying to get the circumstance exactly the same as previous. Same time of day, same conditions, same chants, etc.
And they take the masculine.
And take the masculine. However, do it enough times, and that itself is culturally dictated how many times, because in truth, all that's necessary is once, and it can be repeated any time. The fully adept mind would not need to take it ever.
Right, and I see that once it becomes part of your environment, to relate to our earlier experience, once you have the matter, makes you have the experience, then it becomes part of your memory and knowledge and recall pattern, part of your substance, then to replay it is to get trapped, because it seems the tribal rituals around masculine are trying to replay that fantastic experience and forgetting that, no, it's part of your substance, you can replay it, it's a lighter effect, it's a recall pattern that's not as strong as when you first had it as an invisible environment. Now that it's visible and knowable, you can then look for the new invisible environment, however you imagine you could get it from, you know what I mean?
So therefore it's a stepping stone.
Yeah. So you are changed by it.
Oh, yes.
And so people who took LSD are changed by it, but they don't understand that the flash... Rewind and just check.
Okay. People take LSD.
All right, just do that thing, right. People who take LSD, they have the flashback. Because they might believe what Leary said and relate it to psychological problems or spiritual metaphors, they have to realize they've been changed by LSD. You know, beyond chromosome damage, you have changed yourself. And the recall of that should be taken as a factor of remembering the experience. Therefore, there doesn't need to be that much confusion or worry about flashback.
Mm.
The flashback is proof that you've changed.
Yes.
You don't have to worry about it as a damage.
Exactly. At the same time, LSD without Leary's book is not useful. Because you could use Leary's book or you could use a telephone book, in truth. But if you predict the predicted, then you will live the prediction, which is not the same as a masculine experience.
You can't do that with masculine. You can't predict what's going to happen to each individual person.
Or even to the same person. You see, that is the difference between the two substances. Masculine would give you, the first time you take it, you would have that experience. The objective is not to relive the experience, but use the change to find out other parameters of yourself. To take mescaline as a platform, a stepping stone, to find that other transparency, is the objective. But LSD returns you to where you were all the time. The only difference is the neuron firings.
Right, so one would maybe take mescaline in 2 years again after you have properly absorbed it and changed, and then you'd arrive at a new platform, maybe take the mescaline to leap to another level.
That was the ultimate use of it, and because of that, that's why it's been mescaline has been placed in a religious connotation. It's not a recreation drug.
Yeah,
is there? That one would, by taking it, go to first year university, then later go to a second year university, but never to return where one was. Ever. Not the reason for it.
Yeah, see, the Evergreens define second coming as a time of, you know, the religious concept of second coming as a time of perpetual change. The advantage of electric conditions, the service of our society, if you can handle it, is that you don't get stuck in tribal rituals and group patterns that man did in the kind of totalitarian life they had in each little tribe. Mm-hmm. Our society is so fractionalized and individual autonomy as possible under the electric technological environment that we can change and go to higher levels or of experience, I don't know if it's higher, but new levels of experience faster and not be limited by replays.
Exactly. And that is why, where you have a fractionalization of societies, realize that those societies were artificially congregated, artificially cemented together. Because it was the belief that larger, better, etc., etc. And every, it goes through the cycle where it form, break apart, reform. Now, where there are very large tribes, the fractionalization divides tribe into sub-tribe, into sub-tribe, into individual. There is only one tribe, and that's individual. As McLuhan says, eventually it will be one person interacting with one person, interacting with one person, interacting with one person. Consider a person 200 years ago. Who are you, is the question asked. That person will say, he is English, a Londoner, an East Ender, you see, graphically located, geographically secure, and that is his identity. Location is identity. But with fractionalization and the force of fractionalization means that location geographically is not important anymore, but the location of consciousness is. So as geographics decrease, consciousness increases. Who are you? The question we ask you. You would say that you are a North American, Canadian, Torontonian, but not specifically bound by that. Because where were you before? East Coast Canada. You see?
I would. If you ask me who I was now, I would use a lot of McLuhan's ideas. I say I'm discarnate. I'm everybody on the planet. I'm going to be connected now.
So that discarnate, in truth, a word that can be confused with something else, unfortunately.
Yes.
But if you would say discountried, yes. Geographicized, yes.
Yeah, because actually, McLuhan's term discarnate implies going beyond our bodies, beyond our senses, but he meant by that internal sensory life. But we are enhancing our sensory life, basically. But there's a distinction between sensory life and internal sensory life. Well, is that, well, that's a paradox. It's not a necessary distinction, right?
Yes.
All right.
It is to a certain level of consciousness. It's necessary to distinguish between internal, external. What is being realized is that internal is affected by external, external is affected by internal, and there's a symbiosis between the two that causes continual elevation.
Right, and the electric environment has extended our tactile sensorium, which is very inner.
Yes.
So we're living in an inner environment.
Yes. Now, consider the concept of Waldo. Now, a Waldo is a simulacrum of a human that can work in other environments than a human.
Is the computer? I don't know what Waldo is.
It's a person operating a tractor at a distance.
Oh.
He sits on the edge of the field and with his duplicate set of controls, controls the tractor going up and down the field.
Yes.
Hmm? Now, with sufficient feedback, there is no distinguishing between being in that tractor or on the side.
What would be the not discarnate? What would the be you would say that is? Dis what? Dislocalized.
Dislocalized.
Yeah.
Now let us suggest that you have a simulacrum of yourself that's 2 inches tall. It does everything that you command it to do.
Yeah.
It go up a pipe. It tighten a bolt. It adjust a valve.
It looks like me.
It could look like anything.
Yeah.
But as far as you're concerned, you're 2 inches tall. Going through small openings.
Yeah.
Into et cetera, et cetera.
In terms of what I can accomplish.
In terms of what you can accomplish. The point we're stressing is that is a certain ultimate of a certain electric age.
That's in 100 years or so?
No, there's not. Less than 50.
Less than 50?
Yes. Now, consider for a moment that a telephone puts yourself wherever you choose to be.
Yeah. What's wrong with the term discarnate?
It has been used to describe spirits.
Right.
Rather than loss of localization.
Which, if you explain that way, it's a useful term.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's the way Marshall meant it.
Yes.
Yeah. Do you want to say something more about this?
No.
Okay.
Elapsed time, please.
Well, about.
All right. You just brought up something that Michael once asked me many months ago to ask about. He told me that the Russians had made a breakthrough in electromagnetic warfare, I think the term was.
Mm-hmm.
Could you explain a bit of that technology and how they're using it now?
The Soviets are working on very highly classified material that work on phase-shifting electromagnetic waves.
Not like the Philadelphia experiment.
No, very
those different. Kind of issues.
No, different. Very different.
And what can it do?
Well, it creates a field in which normal electrical flow ceases. It is virtually the opposite of a superconductor. It stops electrical flow.
And how can this be used in attacking or warfare kind of thing? It make people fall down?
It make people fall down, yes. It cause equipment to stop working. It is not yet being able to be projected. It work in a field, and there's been no shaping of the field as of yet.
Are other intelligence agencies not in the USSR aware of this?
Oh, yes, they're aware of it.
Are the Russians aware that they are aware of it?
Not all of them, a few.
And so are they in dialogue with the other people in other intelligence agencies about what they're doing?
Not intelligence agencies, but a considerable amount of work is being done in the Soviet Union on this, but they're keeping much of this information classified, much of it, to their chests.
Right, but those that have access to them, is there a certain trust there that they will tell people from other parts of the world?
a crass 93-94 more, but it's considered an anomaly at the moment. It's not considered a great potential because it cannot be focused, and it requires a considerable amount of technology to accomplish this. But it works surprisingly well. It gets more shared across the next several years as the world goes through this area of tension, and then as that abates, then more sharing after that.
The way you spell out, the Russians are leading in this.
Yes.
They've got the edge. They've invented something, discovered something that other people don't have. The way you say the phrase "area of tension," I've been thinking about that the past week. Someone told me the other day that George Bush has been planning and preparing for the scenario we have in the Middle East now for years, for a potential war. Is this that archetypal Armageddon scenario that's concentrated in the Middle East? We're going to go through that, and that's what you mean by area of tension. We've got this backlog to go through there, right?
Yes, much has to be solved.
Beg your pardon?
Much has to be solved.
Much of the implied racism between the different oligarchies,
et cetera.
Yeah, and that's, we've come to that head. So, I mean, I'm optimistic. I think the Evergreens are optimistic, but we have come this fall to the Armageddon scenario that people have been looking for.
But this, we assure you, is not Armageddon.
Right, it's not going to happen.
No, this is not the final. But at the same time, much solved by it. Much solved by it. Realize, for the first time in the history of man, there's been a concerted effort against an aggressor. That aggressor has no allies.
That's new.
That's very new. First time in recorded history.
Now, the final Armageddon, what is the date of that, or the potential of that?
The final Armageddon? Very, very different. Very different. When there are no aggressors, consciousness changes. It's not peace that people want, because peace is not an absence of war. But to go beyond peace, not to go beyond war, but to go beyond peace is the answer.
But
this must end soon.
Well, the final Armageddon is 2,000 years from now?
The greatest Armageddon of all is when you realize that almost all of the knowledge that you've gained can be shifted by the introduction of new knowledge. That's Armageddon. Not of war, but a vast, vast leap in knowledge. And that happened within the next 500.
And that's what McLuhan implied.
Yes.
Yeah. That resonates.
And now this must end.
Okay. Is there any final comment?
This end.
Thank you. Dear Lord, please enfold these entities in thy love and thy perfection. Amen. Please clear any negative influences from these entities now. Allow the body to become completely relaxed, perform any healing which may need to be performed. Begin increasing the blood pressure to normal naturally, and begin returning all other systems of the body to normal naturally now.
Dan.
And thank you for our sessions, and fairly well.
We do thank you. To you both. God's blessing.
Thank you. And now I would like Michael to awaken, feeling completely refreshed, relaxed, and loved. Now.
Came out of that session, seeing a person who was from the 1200s in this environment today. Now, it's not that he would be imposing his superstitions on top of this. And it's not that it wouldn't take him long to get used to it, but the stresses created by it would be enormous. Just enormous. Patterns of his life would be changed by the very fact that you don't go to bed when it gets dark. and you don't have to light rushes, and therefore you don't have to spend time making rushes.
So what's he going to do?
So the light goes on, and he's waiting for nightfall. You know, looks out the window, sees it is nightfall. Looks inside the room, it's brilliantly lit. In fact, more brilliantly lit than if it was sunshine.
That's like being on LSD.
Confusion
of signals.
total confusion. Couldn't understand, would understand a television set, but have to teach himself to see it. It would be moving too fast for him. Everything would be moving too fast. We speak too fast. We think too fast. We think too fast.
Yeah.
In other words, what's 6 times 6? 36. He would say, 1200s man, would say 6 times 6 is 36. That pause in there is, doesn't sound like much, but it's indicative of almost everything else. Take him time to think. And I like you say to him, 5 minutes before lunch, what would you like for lunch? And he didn't really have to think about it.
Yeah.
Well, he knows what he's like, but he doesn't. It's, you know, having a restaurant is an incredible experience.
Yeah.
I mean, other people prepare food for you. Yes.
Now, does this person get used to it? Or is it just a life of stress and has a heart attack and dies? No?
Well, he gets used to it, but he's not in sync with it, if you know what I mean. Never get in sync with it, really. He just goes along and copies the pattern. But
which would alienate other people from him.
He'd be isolated. Yeah. But he'd be amazed by the amount of genius in this world.
He would be.
Amazed by it.
Well, he'd think that the gods had landed.
Everybody's a god. Yeah. Everybody's a god.
And then that would be very alienating to him.
Yeah, very, very.
He'd feel isolated that he's not... He's in the wrong place.
Oh, yeah.
He's not equipped to be a god.
No, he's not equipped to be a god. Consciousness equips a person to be god.
Now, McLuhan, one of his early books, consciousness equips a person to be god. What is consciousness?
I wanted to get into that. I backed off.
We were talking about as much as language could say it.
They said one phrase, and I just went, wait a minute.
What was that?
What was that?
Let me tell you.
Go ahead. Okay.
They said that consciousness is not me. That's the people, there are those who believe that, but it's not true. Now, I don't say consciousness is me, but I do say consciousness cannot flourish in a human being if the identity is not developed.
Okay.
The me is not developed, so it's dependent on a me.
Okay.
The me is sort of consciousness in a way.
Well, it's only a fraction of consciousness. Only a fraction of consciousness. It's a vital point. Agreed.
Right. I think, in our dialogue with the Evergreens, we say something. And just like they said, it's me. They would say, we're way off on that, but the nature of language to emphasize this point at this moment, and it's true. But so they would agree with you.
Yeah. I think so.
You know what I mean? Even though you pick up on that one point, it's both true. It's mercurial.
You've got to have... You've got
to... It's true and not true at the same time.
But what I get down to it is, identity is an element of consciousness. But one thing is, consciousness continually reinforces identity. Continually. To be free. So here we have my identity as a person in 1200s is limited by the nature that I live in. We have, to an extent, overcome nature.
Yeah.
Our cycles have changed, etc. I can pick up the phone. I'm in contact with Vancouver in seconds.
Yeah. Faster than you can contact your neighbor here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If we had a race between Allie and I on the telephone and the next door neighbor, she'd win.
Yeah.
So our consciousness is literally changed. Now, are we any smarter? Yes. We're a hell of a lot smarter because of that.
But we have the paradox of existence is that you have new problems with your new smartness.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? That's what they were talking about, the complexity of when you're looking at your lives.
Right.
And when you're dead, you keep creating a new complexity. So the dialectic's always there. The tension is always there, we'll call it. You know what I mean?
The learning tension. The tension of needing to learn.
Yeah.
Or of thinking, am I covered? Am I going to get hurt? We should ask about pain or something there.
Yeah, well, anyway, came out of that session with one thing that was very, very important, and that's for the time in which a person lives, they're very smart. Very smart.
Yeah, humans have always been smart.
Have always been smart to the parameters of the situation that they're in.
Right.
Yeah, there's a part of us that doesn't change. It's the attentiveness of consciousness is always the same.
Yeah, the attentiveness is always the same.
Yeah.
It's the means by which consciousness uses itself that it expands. It's almost like consciousness is like any muscle. It gets stronger if you exercise it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And the muscle's changing because you change your muscles.
You change your muscles.
You're mutating your body, then you exercise it differently.
Exactly.
By using TV.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. As an example.
What was interesting came out of that. I was watching a little kid who was watching television. Thoroughly engrossed in it. It was a Sesame Street something.
Yeah.
The kid was thoroughly, thoroughly enjoying it. As he was watching, the neurons in his brain were forming, strengthening, and etc.
Well, you could see them.
You could see that. You could see all the neurons in
you
the brain.
You could know it. Well, yeah, you weren't seeing lights flashing, but you
knowing
that.
Knowing that. And the other one was seeing two hemispheres of the brain and the connecting corpus callosum.
Yeah.
Seeing that. Now, this is going to be a real contentious because, oh, my God, this can be read two ways, and I don't want it to be.
By us?
By everybody.
Okay.
But as consciousness increases, so does the corpus callosum.
The brain's going to change.
Yeah, the brain's changing. Physically, the brain is changing.
The corpus callosum, the connector between the two.
Becomes thicker and thicker and
because
thicker.
Because it's more, getting more stuff.
More communication.
Well, our skull's going to get bigger or something?
No.
Well, the corpus callosum, the thing that connects the two halves. If it gets bigger, that just means there's more interchange between the two halves.
Yeah, it's going to be a stronger internal muscle.
So internal
its
muscle.
Shape.
Yeah.
Within its parameters of our normal skull.
Yeah. And that's it.
Oh, all right.
Well, that was fucking awesome. Couple of people are watching it while having their, or listening to this while having a Thanksgiving dinner, and that's the way to have Thanksgiving. Listen to Evergreen's probe with new information. So let's see who's hanging around.
All participants are now unmuted.
Enthusiastic about what you've just heard.
That was awesome.
Yeah, it was. Glad you're still sane, Madeline, and can recognize osmosis when it happens.
It's interesting about identity being, they were talking about identity being tied to location and then the new environment not so much. And then I was thinking about all the people calling into this Bob Fest from all over the world and sharing, well, they were saying that it's consciousness and not location, like where you are in consciousness versus
right.
where you are geographically that ties you together. And that's evident in what we're doing here, I think.
Yeah, well, Sider Summers had said that. He said, he said, knowledge Armageddon, that seems what is happening now with Ion. Question mark, that was one. Then he said, didn't he say another one similar to that? That might have been what I was thinking of. Maybe that's the one that you saw that, didn't you? Armageddon, this changing of consciousness. And do you see over the next 500 years, or you know, we have different. It's not going to be peace. There'll be continuing being wars and bigger wars. That the most simple thing to cover that is to say the medium is the message, because when final Armageddon is due to a technology that's going to cause a war. Every technology causes a war. And the technology will be so drastic. We will know. I think I've done more on this, as Evergreen's later. We will know more. We will know that we will forget everything we knew. And there will be a big battle over whether to press the button to implement the new technology or not. And everybody will know that the medium is the message at that point. You see what I'm saying?
It already is.
Yeah, well, we learned in the 20th century that, intuitive, that people could see, they went through so many changes. But it becomes a truism, but a practical truism. The only thing to know, the environment will change all parts of your consciousness. This is what Madeline was trying to get at.
Well, and Bob, the thing that we talked about, you know, the other day, Armageddon, being what Michael said, you know, the most radical thing you could do is alter your perception and your knowledge of every single thing. That is Armageddon, and that's what the Revelations talks about, is the Armageddon of confronting the seven layers of heaven and all the different schools and media environments and everything, and learning that you don't know anything, which is what you were so irritated about, hearing me sound as if I thought I knew something. I don't,
in the midst
know.
Of being changed. You had no clue you were being changed.
Yeah, so, you know, it's great. Now I know I don't know anything, and I don't care. I have need for knowledge anymore, but, you know.
Let me add an important point about that, Ginny. What you mean by that is concepts. Literate ideas are not important. Usually the content of your thinking. You will use ideas when you're required to speak about it, but it's not your ground. But a literate person makes ideas their ground, and it becomes a belief system, thinking a thought or a concept a long time. We've moved into what McLuhan says is a world of percept. We value perceptual change, not conceptual change.
The literate idea as my ground is not any longer part of my world or my identity, nor do I rely on, even though I can engage them and talk about them, but it is from a rear-view mirror aspect. That is correct.
Yeah, and most of the 20th century were different attempts by groups and peoples to make people be aware that perceptual change is more important than conceptual change. And it was tried all by all the different movements and revolutions. And it seems that ION is pretty good as the latest version of it, because it itself is a change. It's a technology, it's a change, and it knows, it's the first time we have a changing, an environment to change us, that knows it's going to do that to us and warn us. You know, Leary's LSD pills did not get up and talk and tell us what we're going to do. What it's going to do to you. You know what I mean?
Yes,
Leary had to do it.
I don't think the LSD pills told you what they were going to do to you, and in addition, I'm not sure that it was sustainable. That's why they called it a trip.
Right.
This whole thing with the RNA drops and this environment, which is funny, rearview mirror, even reflectively to listen for 3 years ago. I mean, that was, we started on October 20th. I moved here on October 16th. I had been here for
4 days.
When we started this whole thing, and, you know, Greg and I have been talking about it off and on today, and it's a major what occurred in terms of dispelling and disputing every single thought system, literate or otherwise, really. I mean, just it's incredible.
Okay, now listen, in 1970, when the instant replay came in, which is recording technology, video and tape recording, would be the greatest metaphysical changer in humans. That's what McLuhan said. It's the fact that you can have those experiences on October 20th, and 3 years later, rehear the experience from a whole new perspective. See, that's totally new. And that's changing how you evaluate what happened in the past. Because you can evaluate what happened. You get that? The instant replay is the most important, up to ION maybe, a technological change.
Yes, and I can agree with that, and I don't know if I can. I'm not even sure I could evaluate it. I could notice some things about it, that's for sure.
But you are able to, we are able to do this with playing these recordings, which I did these 22 years ago, and right at the right time with the whole world listening, we play this. I thought this LSD thing was really important for Thanksgiving. It turned out, you know?
Yeah, it was awesome. It's absolutely awesome.
Yeah. I think someone else wanted to say something.
I was just wondering if that recording is analog recording.
Yes, it is. And then it was made digital by George Renault in 2004.
This was my next question. Thanks.
What was your next question?
When it became digital was my next. You already answered it.
Yes. Zen again writes on the chat room, perceptual change over conceptual change, right? Then he goes, that was McLuhan? I said, yep, that's what gave McLuhan the edge on Leary and everybody. Castaneda.
Is that because he could remain subjective instead of objective?
No, he read the right guys. He read what I like to call the vortices. They're all part of the Voices movement. Wyndham Lewis, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, W.B. Yeats, and James Joyce. All of them went on to develop incredible art independent of each other. But they all started off being influenced by the same things, and especially influenced by Wyndham Lewis. And they all were studying the changes to their art. They weren't trying to paint a painting or make a piece that had some arousing, you know, Beethoven revolutionary emotion. They knew their art was obsolete. Their tools were obsolete. So they were looking at the new technologies that were making their work obsolete and dealing with the process of communication. So they started thinking about it. And then McLuhan comes on later, has the benefit of hindsight, and is able to improve on all the stuff that those guys did. But when he became famous in 67, they asked him, where did he get it from? And he said, I got it from Wyndham Lewis, who was the founder of the Vortices. So it's a great logical conclusion to Western cultural history, what these guys did. And Bucky Fuller was in the middle of it too, he being a friend of McLuhan. You see, it's a great tradition that the West was Christian and became a universal culture because of the imposition of the printing press. Well, the ideas and thinkers that came out of the Christian culture are relevant for the rest of the world. Even though it's not Western imperialism, because they pointed out how Western imperialism was obsolete by the very technologies that were changing the world. Right?
Yes, correct.
Yeah. And that's what the political factions, the right, left, and center, do not acknowledge. They do not acknowledge these kind of people. That were the completion of the Western literate tradition. You have Alexander Pope's The Dunciad, you know, 1730s and 40s.
Evergreens is the name we have given to the group of entities numbering between 6.5 and 7,000.
Must have bounced to the next session. It would have run out. Alexander Pope, he writes this thing in the 1740s, The Dunciad, where he's the first to point out the disservices of the printing press. Right? It's been around for over 200 years. And then you have all the reactions to this sentiment. And then you have Romanticism, then Realism in the 19th century, and then Van Gogh, then all the art movements. Finnegan's Wake completes, fully conscious, completes what the Dunciad, what Alexander Pope's Dunciad did. It started to analyze the effects of the printing press. Then Finnegan's Wake comes in and analyzes the later technologies and their effects. And one of the main characters is Belinda the Hen, which that picture, that new picture being over my shoulder, you see the painting by Saul Field, is called Marsh McLuhan and Belinda the Hen. Belinda the Hen, Belinda, I think, is a character in The Rape of the Lock, one of the famous Alexander Pope's poems. Anyways, that literary tradition, this is not taught to students of the humanities in the Western technology. What happened is that all the postmodernists and post-structuralists and deconstructors that took over education in the 80s and 90s, they all were reacting to Joyce and McLuhan. And those teachers don't even know it. The guys that are teaching Derrida, Baudrillard, Deleuze and Guattari, Lyotard, Barthes, they all knew it. And so there's a huge suppression of this information, largely because the radical professors saw McLuhan as a Catholic, and that was a no-no. You're not going to make a Catholic a famous person intellectually. It was a contradiction in terms, most people thought. So you have the leftists and right wings, they try to find someone else. And only yours truly preserves the actual facts, blah, blah, blah. And there we end up with the new Armageddon brought in by Ion. That's the end of my point. I turn the microphone over to someone else.
I'd like to share something. When I was in third grade, I took the MAT6 test. It was like the first computerized test when we just put out all these bubbles. Then the next year I was enrolled in a program that went on for years, and I don't remember much about school other than this because it was called PD. And I just remember I'd get on a bus and a couple days a week go to a different school, and the teacher read to us. We could lay on the floor with a pillow. We could have water, drink snacks at any time. We could go outside if we wanted to. There was no raising hands. We were told right away to speak in turn, and you just wait. If you really want to raise your hand, you put it up, pull it down. And we learned a lot of these kinds of concepts very young, but it was a select few just from this town. I don't know. I've never been able to find the program anywhere else.
And so who brought the school brought the program in, not one teacher?
The school accepted government aid, and it was funded by a private funder from this town that I live in, and they run a company called French Oil.
Right. So what happened to the kids in that new kind of undisciplined or relaxed environment?
It was interesting, too, because we did a lot with computers, a lot. Like Oregon Trail was... It was like, thank you, finally I get to play something. But if nothing else, it was Oregon Trail, dysentery. But the kids, man, I like what I did with the stuff that I learned. Most of the people that I'm in touch with from the program, they're not so happy. They all appreciated it, but it was kind of like their spotlight moment, and that was third grade.
That was the third grade. The third grade was their peak learning.
Yeah, it was like third through fifth grade or something.
Yeah.
So it it didn't carry over for them.
And, well, that's the environment I understand you're in. It's lower working class, unemployed, ghetto, white trash kind of zone. There's no environment to keep it going for them. Isn't that a factor?
Well, that's not... Okay, it is and it isn't, because there's a very, very big ghetto portion, but then there's also the people that have a house here, that also have a house in Florida, that also have a house in New York, that also have a house in California, you know, and they live up on the hill in the geographical location where I'm.
Right.
And so they kind of flood down these little offerings like PD, Project Discovery, you know.
So they funded the school. Did their kids, were there any of their kids in your classroom?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Right.
Absolutely.
So they had the money to make their kids' education better.
Yes, we had a cultural program too called Muse Machine, and we got to do trips to different theater groups and poetry readings, things like that too. So,
yes, that's good. So, the interesting thing is, all your friends that didn't have a great much other than that, they went on to engage in the global classroom of media. And that leads all kinds of excesses in different ways, but that's their classroom.
They're either hackers now or public school teachers.
Right, right. They go to the future technology or the older technology, but they're in the information environment both ways. Right? Oh, were you coughing?
Absolutely.
Were you coughing there?
Mm-mm. Someone else.
So, not everybody became a hacker. I'm saying that most of them had lives upset, changed, little Armageddons due to the global classroom of technology and media.
Yes, and you know what I think was the hardest thing? I mean, my favorite, we would get there in the morning. We would take our coats off over our heads because you don't pull your zipper down. You know, that pulls your energy down. So we take our coats off over our heads, and then we would do, bilateral training, tapping on our legs.
That sounds like a Waldorf school. That's
and then we would walk.
Right?
And then we would walk.
Hey, isn't that Rudolf Steiner, Waldorf kind of education? Maybe you didn't know.
Yeah,
that's
there's
Steiner
just
talk.
A lot of, there's a lot of neurological resources that are set up right here too, so they had influence with that.
Right.
It was kind of like they allowed the quote unquote experts or specialists to kind of participate with the children, I think.
And did that program bring out your artistic abilities?
Yeah, absolutely. I was encouraged. I got to be. I was taught about time travel, and I was taught about performance art.
at that
right.
young.
Right, see, that must have been a Steiner school. Anthroposophy or Waldorf school. Now, the interesting thing is, I get the sense that you personally have continued, as an artist, you like to put yourself into that feeling that grade three puts you into. You're always trying to be in that little classroom feeling.
Yeah, I suppose so. It's very idiosyncratic, very mnemonic. It's very personal, intimate. Why would you not want that kind of environment? Why would I crave anything else?
Right. But I keep thinking now, that's a private expression form of art. Now, the Vortices came in 1914 and on, up to 1922, and dealt with the obsolescence of private expression because you had corporate, collective means of expression. Movies, radio, magazines, advertising, newspapers. That created the crisis for private art. And so the Dadaists said art is obsolete. But they didn't have it really articulate. Didn't have it be so dramatic. They were saying private expression, the kind of art you like, is obsolete. And remember, back then everybody wanted to get it right because they were trying to change the world, bring in a communist revolution or a socialist revolution or fascist. They all were politically engaged because there was still the human scale where you felt you could have a say in the matter. So art was obsolete, and then the surrealists came in and altered visual space. And then you have the very abstract art with no visual content. All that was trying to preserve private expression, and some of them found out unique ways to do it, like Klee and Mondrian and Jackson Pollock. But Wyndham Lewis is unique because he continued making great paintings and writing, but his real desire was to be a consultant, a think tank, and organize city planning. He wanted to work on the environment. That's what he knew was the new art.
Well, see, there too, my grandpa was a municipal...
Wait, someone's reacting. Do I hear someone else saying, sighing? Or speaking or grunting?
Was it Jenny?
Jenny. Oh, wait, here's Leon. He's not available. He's not plugged. Was that Ginny or Allison? Or?
No, Bob, that wasn't me.
No gasping yet from you. Okay. So, go ahead, Sarah.
I'm back, Bob. You can stop the show now.
Well, tell me how many hours is it? Because I have one more awesome evergreen session I'm going to play. But how are we for the timing?
At our 12 o'clock, it'll be 141 hours.
Good. We're going to go and get that 144.
I think so.
Yeah.
Yay.
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 You see, the kids don't want to go home, Carol, and it's such a great school here.
I know. It's wonderful. And thanks for waiting for me.
Yes, and you had a client or something?
Yeah.
Right. Okay, so Sarah, what was your last idea that you were just saying?
I was just going to say, I was told very young, too, that municipal, that's very important. My grandpa has started municipal power plants around the country, and that's kind of how I ended up here, but with I was born in Alabama, moved
right.
to New York, St. Louis, all these places. Anyway, so the, you know, sharing energy and having communities able to do that themselves and independently, that was a very big passion of my grandfather's.
To have communities have what independently?
Power, electricity.
Oh, okay.
Electricity, yeah.
Well, he was a tetra manager in the sense that he was working with environments that changed perceptions, you know, obviously, or changed more than perceptions, changed media.
He built computers, he went in, he set up the power plants in these towns, then he went into their public systems and taught the managers of the cities how to run the power plants, then he moved to another town and do that.
Well, you liked Wyndham Lewis. I would go back and read as many Lewis books as possible and look at it. This is the thinker that was thinking on your father's level. Your father your grandfather did it. Lewis was thinking about the effects of being that kind of person. You know, what your grandfather does. I was going to read the Lewis books. I thought I'd have a lot more time and read the Lewis books, but I never got to do that. But that's okay. It was on the record to read Hitler and the other one, The Doom of Youth, which is him in 1932 talking about pop kid culture, advertising culture, an early version of McLuhan's Mechanical Bride. So, unless there's nothing else going on, we'll go to part two, the next great, well, an equally great